This morning, and we'll be reading from Genesis 1, verse 1 to 5. There's a sermon, it's titled, How Long is a Day? An introduction, and we can't wait to hear this. Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, Let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
I truly hope that as we've been doing these studies that you mightn't be thinking that this is taking longer than it should. It's so important when we're looking at the scriptures that we, in order to grasp perhaps what it's saying more clearly, is to set it always against a broader background, as we've been saying. And that takes time, and when you come to such difficult passages as we are entering in today, I felt the need that we really need to stand back from this and to set this in its full context, given the issues that we have with this word day. And so I hope that you'll forgive me that, I will be standing back and be looking more at an introduction today before we come to perhaps more clearly defining what this word means in Genesis 1. So I would like, in that line, therefore, to call your attention back this morning to verses 3 to 5 of chapter 1 in the book of Genesis, and where we read again verse 3, And God said, Let there be light, and there was light. Verse 4, And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And then verse 5, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. Now, those verbs used of God in the sentences we've just read, on the surface of it, seem purely incidental. But we rightly read them in the way they've been written so that they express God's activity in day one of creation. But beyond the obvious reading, which expresses God's activity, those verbs reveal to us other important things about God as well. God said, Let there be light. That's God's mandate or fiat. And there was light is the fulfillment of God's fiat. And we see that's a recurring thing that happens in Genesis 1. There's the fiat and then there's the fulfillment. And there was light is the fulfillment. But together they express the power of God to speak things into creation, into being. That's what they teach us. Then verse 4, God saw that the light was good. That's God's objective imprimatur on his creative works. That it was both pleasing for him to look at, but it was also good to the standard of God himself. It was perfect, without blemish. It was impeccable. And remember, God's speech is infinitely beyond vocalized communication, dependent on lungs and vocal cords and tongue, Just as God's seeing is infinitely beyond merely light entering the eye and being processed by the brain, having traveled along the optic nerve as when we speak. No, these verbs express not merely in some sense anthropomorphisms, they also express profound truths about God when they're used of Him. So that fiat and fulfillment by decree infer God's omnipotence. Just as His imprimatur of good infers His perfection. And so when God sees His work in toto, it infers His omniscience. And so God's next act then was to divide or separate the light from the darkness. And that immediately raises a logical issue for us when we read it at first glance. How are we to understand this separating? How does one separate light from darkness? Is there some kind of line that somehow differentiates them? Perhaps as even Job says in places. And it seems to our minds to be a logical conundrum to try to understand it. But that is until you remember that light and darkness is being spoken of here as related to the earth. Remember, earth is now center stage. The earth is now the focus of the first chapter. And light is focusing on the earth. And so separating of light from darkness makes total sense if we see it in that way. And that's exactly what verse 5 goes on to explain. And we're told there that light is the day and is separated from the darkness which is the night. And what facilitates that dividing of the light from the darkness or from the day, we're told from the night, are the periods of evening and morning, or periods where it's not quite light and not quite darkness. And the reason that happens is because the earth is rotating before the light source, which is now illuminating the earth's center stage. And so what we have in this most straightforward reading of the text in context is the creation of day one. One complete day. Verse 5. And when you examine these verses of chapter 1 in that way, the logic of those verses make absolutely perfect sense. Remember verse 1. God, it begins with God creating the heavens and the earth. All that make up creation. Verse 2 describes the yet uninhabitable earth in a state of being formless and void, whatever that meant, and of being enveloped in a watery womb, and of being in total darkness because there was no light as yet. And then verse 3 brings the light to the earth, providing the essentials for life. And it's the first step in making the earth habitable for man. Verse 4 divides darkness from light by rotating the earth before the light source. And so in doing that, the rotation produces, verse 5, the first full day, morning, evening, night. It's a straightforward logical work here as we look at it simply in the text. But then to stamp His rule over creation, now focused on man, where he will soon live, on the earth and under the heavens, God called the light day and the darkness He called night. In other words, when God named what He created by fiat, in naming His works, He was saying that they were all by right His. That everything, including day and night, darkness and light, and later in verses 8, 9, and 10, the heavens and the earth and the seas, which He also names, that everything was His. that he's the creator and that he's also the rightful ruler of his creation. Yes, it's an earth under the heavens, created for man to live on and to fill and to rule over as God's vicegerent, but it's nevertheless still God's creation. Creation which is his by right, and so creation which is his to rule. And all of that is implicitly inferred in these short verses we've been looking at. And the implication of what's being inferred in these verses is that in man being appointed as God's vicegerent on earth, it means that the earth isn't there for man to do as he wants to do with it. Or that his God-given mandate to subdue it isn't meant to mean that he sucks dry every valuable resource out of it so that it returns to that state of tohu vavohu as it was before. No, it's God's earth, and man is just God's caretaker over it. And so it also implies that our lives are not ours to live as we like. And the laws which we constitute to live under aren't meant to be merely by mutual consent and by what we, the people, determine to be. And neither are our physical lives, personal lives, private lives, to be lived as I want or as I say. And if you do believe that God is the creator, then part and parcel of that deal is to obey him also as the ruler of your life. You don't have a say in that. And you can't have one without the other. No, the implication of a universe created by God means we are to live under his rule. Because as our creator, he is likewise our ruler. So having already painted last week and this morning a little the broad context of verses 3 to 5 and the creation of day 1, and then gone out to draw out some theological implications and practical implications from it, let's now, in an introduction, look at that vexed question. What does day mean in the verse we've just read and indeed in the rest of the chapter? So let's start with the word day itself. In the Hebrew, it's the word yom. Now, some of you will have heard the word Yom Kippur, or you would have heard of the Yom Kippur War. And the Yom Kippur War was an Arab-Israeli war, which was briefly fought in 1973. And it was named that because of the Arab coalition led by Egypt and Syria. They launched a surprise attack on Israel on their holiest day of the year, the day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And so there, Yom means day, as Kippur means atonement. A great deal, as we know, has been generated over the years over this meaning of this word day in Genesis 1. And what began perhaps as a small wisp of smoke in the days of the early church fathers has in more recent times been fanned into a relative bushfire. And the tinder which has generated that combustion smoulders under the issue concerning the length of days in creation week. So the question then is, how long are the days mentioned in creation week? Are they literal 24-hour solar days, where solar refers to the sun or to the light source, and it means the time that it takes for the earth to complete one full rotation on its axis before the light source, so that the days are literally 24 hours in length from morning to morning? Is that what it means? We're speaking of literal days. And of course, the implication of that is that the age of the universe must only be a few thousand years old, because creation took place in 6 24-hour literal days, which is in total contradiction to what science is saying, in that the forming of this earth and the forming of life on earth took millions of years. Now that's the view we take, I think, and the view that's been held from around the time of the Reformation, in which time it was the predominant view, the 24-hour solar view, or the literal view. And clearly, when the Reformation took place, a number of factors saw that position become the dominant position from there on. And not least of those factors was the reforming of a hermeneutical principle in reading our Bibles. And that included rejection of the prevailing allegorical method of Bible interpretation and a return to the more robust method of interpreting the Bible literally. And because of that, Genesis itself was seen then to be understood by interpreting it literally and not allegorically, as had been up until that time by and large. So, broadly speaking, that's what we have. The strength of the literal interpretation appears to stem from the Reformation, even though there were clearly hints before that and indications before that. And the position is the literal position. Then another take on the literal solar day position is to say that because the sun doesn't appear until verse 14, that is the fourth day, that days 1 to 3 are pre-solar days. And so these days aren't necessarily governed by the sun as days 4 to 6 are. In other words, whilst days 4 to 6 are normal solar days, 24-hour days, days 1 to 3 aren't necessarily so, since they are before the creation of the sun. And so perhaps those days were thousands or even millions of years in length. In fact, it's been argued that since time itself is only ever related to solar time, then naturally pre-solar time must be really seen in terms of pre-time itself. Because you think about it, if you took the sun away, time becomes indefinite, or non-cyclic, or immeasurable. Perhaps even in a sense it's eternal. And so there are those who believe that the creation days comprise both of literal days as well as non-literal pre-solar days of extended periods of time. And I suppose from what's written in Genesis alone, from what's written, you'd be hard-pressed to refute that position. And that's because if you just localize your thought to Genesis 1, that is actually factually a possibility. And then if you think about it in favor of that position, is that it tries to remain faithful to the text while also trying to resolve science to the Bible. So we need to remember that. Then a third position concerning the length of days in Genesis 1 is to see each and every day as representing an extended period of time. And that's what's known as the day-age theory. And where day doesn't mean literal solar day, but rather an era or an age. So that each day of creation week comprises many years in length. And where age or era is what we might speak of as when we speak about Adam's day or Adam's era. when we really mean not Adam's day is singular in one day, but Adam's time, the time he lived on the earth for 930 years. Now, this is the view, of course, that lies behind the theory of theistic evolution, where God is seen as the creator, but who designed evolution into creation as the means by which life would be generated. So for the theistic evolutionists, God created, and he created all that was necessary to produce life through evolution and over extended periods of time. And those extended periods of time the Bible calls days or epochs, each progressively under the control of God. And in fact, how the Bible describes the order of development in Genesis 1 is an order that even unbelieving evolutionists actually agree with. Now, they don't believe in a creator, but the order from Big Bang to the forming of a planet to its continental development and the emergence of plant life and sea creatures and birds, followed by land creatures and man, all in that order, they do actually agree with. And in a sense, theistic evolutionists, in their attempt to reconcile science of evolution with the Word of God, see the order, but they see that God, not chance, designed the order. And so the way to reconcile both Bible and evolutionary science is to understand creation days as being long days, non-literal, figurative days, deliberately designed for the purpose of evolution. And so I hope you can see that many, in fact, many of the great minds in the past, faced with this new scientific theory which challenged the Bible, weren't trying to undermine or reject what was believed of the Bible, but they were trying to reconcile what they firmly believed with what this new branch of science was so boldly stating in their day. So that's the extended day period understanding of the day. Then we come to what's known as the framework theory. And it's what's referred to in terms of the literary interpretation. And I suppose the best way to grasp this theory is to say that it rejects the days of creation week as being representative of time altogether. Whether literal time or solar time or figuratively extended periods of time, it rejects the concept of time altogether. And for the literary interpretive method, length of days is absolutely irrelevant. And the proponents of this position, which seems to now be the common position in the theological seminaries and colleges around the world these days, they believe that Genesis 1 was written, and when it was written, that it was furthermost from the mind of the author was to give a detailed description of creation week. And that questions of the earth's age and the universe's age would never have been an issue to him then. But rather that dating the earth and dating the universe is something that only Western post-Enlightenment thinkers have imposed on Genesis 1. So that questions such as the age of the earth and the universe would never have ever entered into the Hebrews' mind at all. And so what's conjectured by this view is that the Hebrew in his day was only concerned about the whos and the whys of the issues of life, and not by the scientific hows of the issues of life. No, theirs, they say, was a much more down-to-earth practical and religious attitude and not a scientific attitude to life. So, for example, when the crops failed because of drought or locust infestation, their focus wasn't on weather patterns or the effects of El Nino. Their focus was on the who it was who sends the rain and the locusts, and why it was that this one had withheld the rain and sent the locusts. Is it because God, who blesses our crops with rain and who has promised to provide for us and protect us, is saying something to us? Is it because we've offended him? That's what they're saying. That's how they would have viewed life and thinking, in a very practical way. And that's because they were supposedly unscientific, too unscientific to ask how the rains came and how they were regulated and affected by external and natural factors. And so, likewise, with regard to Genesis chapter 1, it wasn't how the universe was created or how long the days of creation that mattered to the Hebrew. Those things, we're told, never entered into his mind, but rather that it was God. That's what the whole thing was. God created. That's all that mattered, they say. That's all that's important. And so from that basis, where the details of science and length of days and ages and such were irrelevant to the ancient Hebrew mind, the literary theorist proposes a theory which saw it plainly, that days were irrelevant, but that the text provided other information more relevant in terms of parallels in days. Where days are non-literal days, but rather are literary devices used by the author to frame the what of creation and not to explain the how of creation. That's the stepping back from the position that this was the mind and the modern thoughts would never have entered into the Hebrew's mind. So the days are meant to not to be literal days, but rather figurative representations or pictures of God's creative work. And it's important that we grasp this, because this is the most current trend today. And so from then, the framework's theorist's position, days are something like a box of photos. And the framework theorists love their analogies. And the most common one probably is the days are like a box of photos. They're snapshots or pictures. And they're snapshots of literal events. But the days themselves aren't literal. They're events, not measured by time, solar or extended. And they're events which aren't necessarily chronologically arranged. So you pull out one picture, and you pull out another picture, and you pull out another picture. These are pictures of creation. Or to use another analogy that they use, they say that the days in creation week are like clothes pegs on a washing line. And the sole purpose of the pegs on the line are to fix the articles of clothing to it. How you arrange the clothing isn't important. And the pegs themselves aren't important. But what is important is what the pegs, the literary devices, do. They hold up the articles attached to the washing line. And in Genesis 1, one article is the creation of light. Another article is the separation of the waters. Another article is the creation of the heavenly bodies, and so on. So from that basis, length of time of the days of Genesis 1 is totally irrelevant. And framework theorists go on to arrange their findings in terms of a semi-chronological framework, which I'll say more about later. And then I suppose I ought not to admit the view of the days as being the God view days. And this view teaches when God speaks about days, it's not speaking about days as we know them, but as they are days of God's measure. Days which are relative to God and not to ourselves. And so a day could mean almost anything at all. A day could be as 1,000 years, as Peter says, quoting the Psalms. Or it could as easily be 1 year or 1,000,000 years. So God created in 6 God days, whatever that is. And that's a view that's been popular too. Now that's a very broad sweep of the various ways the word day is understood in Genesis 1. And it's by no means a comprehensive list. But it should be said that each of those positions vary within themselves and that they can share things in common with one another. But at least that should give us some understanding of the issues involved when we come to this question of days. So this morning we've looked at a brief introduction discussing the biblical context in which we find this often divisive word in Genesis 1. And we've had a very brief survey of the most popular views that are taken in trying to see some of the positions and trying to understand what lies behind those positions with regard to the word day. And so I just want to take a bit more time and to comment upon this morning when some of those views emerged in the course of the history of the church. And that's a very important thing. And I think it might be helpful to do that because sometimes we assume certain things as fact, when in reality what we assume is entirely wrong. And it may be that some here are thinking that it's only because of the emergence of evolution and because of the impact of modern science that we're being forced to discuss this issue. But that if we just read our Bibles, then there'd be no problem at all. But if that's so, and I truly hope that it's not, then all that infers is sheer naivety. And it might surprise us to learn, therefore, that the issues of the length of creation days predates Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution by hundreds of years. It's not relatively new at all. And from the time of the early church fathers, the 4th century, Justin Martyr and Irenaeus, for instance, explained creation days as being figurative days, not literal days. And as for Augustine, one of the truly great minds of early church history, when he speaks of taking a literal interpretation of Genesis, what he means is a literal interpretation as opposed to the allegorical interpretation, the form which was most prominent in his day. But if you were to read Augustine carefully, in actual fact, he clearly rejected a 24-hour day interpretation of creation days. And he seemed to follow some kind of framework theory, not unlike Clement of Alexandria, Athanasius, and Origen. And remember, these were all 4th century men, the very beginning of the church. And whilst some theologians like Peter Lombard and William Tyndale later favored a literal reading of Genesis in the time of the Middle Ages, so that's between the 5th and the 15th centuries, it was still the allegorical position that was mostly prevailed through that time. And Genesis 1 was largely interpreted along those allegorical ways. Then by the time we come to the 16th century and the Reformation, the allegorical method of interpretation had been shown to be flawed, and a far more rigorous literal interpretation now replaced it. And the likes of Martin Luther and John Calvin and Henry Bullinger all favored a literal 24-hour creation day. And so to round off our brief historical survey, the first mention of length of days in Genesis 1 appearing in the form of a church confession or a statement of faith appears in the year 1600 in the Irish Episcopal Church. And there the literal position is taken of Genesis 1 and Creation Week. And then in 1648, the Westminster Confession of Faith, which lies behind what Presbyterians believe, the Savoy Declaration, 1658, lies behind the Congregationalist Church's belief, and the 1689 Baptist Confession likewise all took the literal view of days in Genesis chapter 1. And so stemming mostly from the Reformation and a return to a literal method of interpreting the Bible, Genesis 1 has since been seen as teaching six literal creation days. And of course, that's what's reflected in those major church creeds of the various reforming branches of the Christian church. But it's then on the release, the publication of Darwin's On the Origins of Species in 1859, we find that in trying to answer the theory of evolution from a biblical perspective, that various views emerged. Because a literal interpretation of Creation Week, which implies a very short Earth age, contradicted the evolutionary hypothesis of very long ages of the Earth. And so we have the emergence of such theories as the gap theory and the other theories that we've considered briefly this morning. And it must be said that the impact of Darwin's origins can never be played down. In fact, it's said that by the 1870s, remember, the work was released in 1859, and so less than 20 years later, the scientific community and the majority of the educated public had accepted evolution as a fact. In the space of 20 years from what was overwhelmingly held at that time as a literal interpretation, they are now seeing that this was no longer the case. Evolution was proving the Bible wrong, at least from that perspective. And so when you consider the historical background, and when and why these various positions of the day of Genesis 1 have arisen, clearly it would be wrong for us to say that the issues of days in Genesis 1 only emerges as a compromise because of Darwin's theory in the 1800s. Yes, that was a groundbreaking thing. But the question of days predated Darwin by some time. And it would be equally wrong to say that creation in Genesis 1 has always been a literal position that the church has always held from the beginning. And the fact is, that's just not the case at all. And we need to be aware of this if we are to be effective in what we say and what we, how we deal with people. Brothers and sisters, when I began the series on Genesis, I made the comment that this book is absolutely foundational to the rest of the Bible. And that if you took away this foundation, a great many doctrines that are built upon it would simply collapse. And today we're seeing exactly that happening. The only way that we'll be able to stand up in our day, and the only way we'll be able to help others stand in our way, is to know why we believe what we believe. And we need to be informed believers to be able to do that. And even though what I've brought to you over these weeks has been more like lectures than sermons, and believe me, as I've mentioned to some of you already, I really struggle with that. My aim has been, nevertheless, to inform you as clearly and as honestly as I can, in order that you might stand and stand in an informed position, not from bias, not from a position of a kind of herd mentality, but from an informed position, which I hope you'll find is based on the Word of God. And in that, I'm reminded of an insider's preacher's joke. You know, this kind that only preachers probably find amusing. And it's to do with the preacher's sermon notes. And on his notes, on the way down as he's going along, there he finds a great red line scribbled under a sentence. And then in the margin are the words written again in red ink, "Yell here, argument weak." You know what I mean. The reasoning is weak, so make your point by yelling louder, or maybe thumping the pulpit once or twice. And sometimes that's what we're all guilty of in arguing our subject, because we don't have the understanding. But that's not the way to reason the Bible. We don't argue simply because we don't agree with someone. We argue because hopefully we have in all honesty listened to them and heard their position. And we've considered all the data. And we've tried to examine all the various data that they presented positively and objectively. And where we disagree, we reason why we believe what we believe from the only objective source of truth, which is authoritative, and not from our passions. And our aim, therefore, is always to help and not to cause unnecessary division and ill-feeling. And so hopefully, certainly it's my prayer, when we get through this vital chapter of Genesis, I pray that you will not only be better informed of what you believe, but that you will have a love and a positive confidence in what you believe, having examined the details. And that will allow you to enable to stand, to be faithful, and to help others. So, at that point, I think we ought to close, and God willing, we'll take up with more precision in trying to deal with this issue of days next time we meet.